name is Karen Blomquist, and I come from Chicago, where I am part of the churchwide staff of the ELCA. I serve as Director of Studies. And just to mention that I'm involved with the development of a whole variety of the church's studies, social statements, and messages on social issues. And there is a brochure, pink brochure, in the on the table out there. I will pass these out later. This is a little bit of a flyer talking about an upcoming major study on economic life that we're just finishing now, and we hope to have in print by the end of the fall. And I'll pass these out because if you want to order a copy while you're here, you can do that. I mention that particular project because my week of sessions this week are focused on some themes, some emphases from that particular study. And as you've heard and as you can see on the board, the overall title of this is Give Us This Day Our Daily Bread. And as we focused on yesterday in the session I had, part of one of the central functions this is trying to do is to show how deeply our Christian faith and economic life are intertwined, even though we often see them as separate. I'm not going to go over all that, make the case for that today, but to build out from at least one of the major themes in that. And as I said yesterday, one of the normative understandings that I think grounds our consideration of economic matters from a Christian perspective is the basic norm that all should have a means by which their basic needs can be met. And I think the reality that we're only all too aware of in our society is that that is not the case for far too many people. Studies came out, for example, last year indicating that the inequality gap between children with families, between poor families and affluent families, is wider in this country than in any developed nation, any other developed nation. And I think that's especially ironic considering that probably for many of us sitting in this room, our immigrant ancestors came to this country saying, well, this is a land of opportunity and equality and all that sort of thing. And yet many of those, especially European countries that they came from, have much less of a gap than do we in this country. Or just another example of that gap. During the 1980s, 98% of the rise in personal income went to the top 20%, the wealthiest 20% of the population. The top 5% of the population, which is basically those who earn more than $120,000 a year, take a bigger share of the national income than the bottom 50% of the population put together. And there's lots of other statistics that we could, just bring up to emphasize some of that. But I at least wanted to put that on as some basic kinds of realities that we're up against. As I said, this petition of the Lord's Prayer is kind of the central theme in this study. And today I want to especially unpack a little bit the implications of what it means for us to pray regularly, give us this day our daily bread. These thoughts about what us evokes. This prayer emphasizes us and our rather than me and mine. We are not saying, give me my daily bread when we pray that. It emphasizes the us rather than the me that is so prevalent in a society that emphasizes the individual. We do not pray only for our needs or of those closest to us, but we pray for all those with whom God sets us in relationship, who are close at hand and throughout the world. The church prays in expectation of the fulfillment of God's reign of unbounded concern for all creation. And as we explored a little bit yesterday, faith in the promise of God's bringing us together leads toward a community that sees itself as we and our possessions as ours. We explored a little bit yesterday how the thou shalt not steal commandment, it was really whatever we don't do to provide for our neighbor's necessities, that those omissions are in a sense violations of that commandment. And so God nudges us into ever-expanding notions of who us includes. Distinctions between us and those who are not us begin to fade. And we are moved to pray for those most different from us, as well as for ourselves and our own needs. In the face of forces that would pit us against one another, enriching some and impoverishing others, God relentlessly seeks to bring people together for the sake of the good of all. I think there's also some resonances there with the theme that I think Ann Peterson is exploring this week. And Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, who's here today, he and I talked about how we had to do our sessions in separate slots, because certainly he's going to also be dealing with some exploration of some of the realities of poverty in our own day. So that, as another reminder, as I said yesterday, hopefully after this week, when we pray that petition, there will be all kinds of implications loaded into that when we pray it in a, and we say, now what, you know, what does it mean, therefore, to think of our neighbor who have much less than we do, that somehow it is, they are a part of the scope of what we are praying for. When we pray that petition. So, some further opening kinds of observations dealing with the reality of poverty in our own day. Overall, statistics show that the rate of poverty has grown in some disturbing ways in recent years. Close to 40 million people in this country live below, at, or barely above the official poverty line. And when you consider how many people who are just above find themselves in very vulnerable positions, this is a somewhat larger number than some of the figures you see, but I think it, because of the movement back and forth, it is the reality for so many people, that more generous figure needs to be used. Marianne?
Karen, what is the poverty line? I mean, can you give what the current definition of the poverty line is?
I think I have it.
Well, you have it here as a $20,000 for a family of three. Is that what you said?
It's probably. Let me look in here.
I know I read it.
It's in here.
I've heard between 13 and 15.
It's probably about, I think the official poverty level would be about $15,000 for a family of three.
And I think yours, what you're saying here, is that to live
a living wage
would be $20,000 for three.
Right. That was according to a study in Minnesota. They said a living wage would be about $20,000.
Right. I remember reading it.
But I think the actual poverty level is about $15,000.
I think
that isn't very generous.
No.
Right. That's right.
No, I just think sometimes we hear that and don't know what it is, what it means.
Right.
And you could kind of identify with what you earn and how you deal with all your
living in poverty and receiving welfare assistance is a short-term, less than two-year, rather than a long-term reality for the majority of the population. Again, that I think is important in light of a lot of the current stuff that's been thrown around in the welfare debate in Congress. In terms of sheer numbers, the face of poverty is actually more white than black, more female than male, more young than old. Evidence points to an increase in the percentage of all segments of the population who work full time but cannot by themselves lift a family out of poverty. And this is especially dramatic among young workers without a college or post-secondary education. Today, a third of all men between the ages of 23 and 34, a third of them, earn less than the amount necessary to keep a family of four above the poverty line. I think that's a significant factor, especially in light of some of the concern of, well, you know, if only they all got married and, you know, a husband to support, well, lots of these husbands, if they were married, would not be able to support. Hispanic men and women are those most likely to be working full-time for low wages. African-American and Hispanics are more likely to live in poverty than are European-Americans. Native Americans are by far the poorest racial ethnic group in our society, although when you do most, when you look at most of the statistics on poverty, they become so invisible that they don't even, often aren't even counted in some of the charts. I think also it's important to recognize that even though the most visible realities of poverty that tend to come to mind are those that are urban realities of poverty, it's also reality in small town and suburban areas and rural areas. In 28 rural counties, not just in the South, but in places like South Dakota, half the children live in poverty. Those as some overall kinds of statistics. Now what I'd like us to do is to try to put some faces on those statistics. I would maintain that one of the difficulties with much of the current debate around welfare reform is that it's driven more by ideological perspectives than by the personal faces of poverty. And for much of this time, we're going to try to get into and unpack some of those ideological perspectives. But before we do that, I want us just to spend a few minutes thinking of some faces of poverty that come to mind for you. What kinds of persons, situations? I'm going to just name out loud eight and see what that evokes for you, or perhaps some other examples that you would want to mention at the end of that. Mary often skips a meal so that her children can eat. Robert decides to pay the overdue rent rather than the heat so that his family will at least have a place to live. Kim eats all she can at school, knowing little food is available at home. Janet earns a minimum wage but finds it far from adequate for supporting her family. Jabara's hope lies not in finishing high school, but in keeping from being killed before he becomes an adult. Carol is viewed as lazy because she wants to care for her three young children at home rather than getting a job caring for other people's children. George lives on the streets, preferring his vagabond life of daily survival over being tied down to a home and family. And the Gonzalez family knows they're economically poor, but they work together to get by in dignity and refuse to think of themselves as poor. What other faces come to mind for you? Situations, dilemmas. Each of these are involved in daily struggles. Can you think of some other kinds of faces, situations that come to mind for you?
How about the woman who's been a housewife and a mother and volunteer all her life? and is left widowed.
Mm-hmm. Or divorced.
Or divorced. Mm-hmm.
And perhaps didn't pursue those educational or other possibilities because she assumes she...
Her education is in an alternate area. Doesn't have a degree.
Older people who live in poverty and are isolated from any contacts.
Other faces, situations.
A woman whose husband has had a stroke and has to make a decision between caring for him at home and going back to work. Mm.
An emancipated.
No income.
An emancipated 16-year-old girl whose father abused her and she needs to be someplace else.
A worker in our local hospital who's being evicted because can't pay the rent. His wife is disabled in a wheelchair.
Any others that come to mind at this point that you want to mention? Okay, I want you to keep some of those faces, some of those realities in mind as we go through the next next several minutes. I'm going to pass these sheets out. These are actually two pages that are excerpted from the study document, and we're going to try an exercise that's listed on here. As I said a minute ago, welfare reform today seems to be driven not by these personal faces and situations that we've just brought to mind, but especially by some ideological perspectives. And I think especially in the context of the current debate over welfare, we in our society tend to choose sides. We're divided by our ideological perspectives. And for most of us, and I'm speaking for myself here also, we tend to avoid or not have much patience with those ideological perspectives with which we disagree. And so what we're going to try to do for a minute is do some discussion and some kind of sharing out loud from out of these different perspectives. I arranged the chairs five clusters, although you've all kind of sat over here, so we're going to have to probably divide you up. Basically, we'd like you to pull together in like five smaller circles. We're going to spend 5 minutes getting acquainted, each group, with one of these perspectives. The idea is then we're going to get into a common discussion, and let me acknowledge up front that this is going to be a difficult exercise for probably all of us in this room, unless you happen to be assigned a perspective that is pretty much where you're at already. Because we're going to try in the plenary to speak from out of, you know, in response to the question of why are people poor or what should be done about poverty today, we're going to try to discipline ourselves to speak from out of that assigned perspective. The purpose of this is to say, hey, you know, it's hard for us to listen to somebody who expresses some of these perspectives that are probably quite different from our own. But can we see, is it possible to see some value in those perspectives? Some partial truths, for example? Because I think one of the difficulties in terms of the common discourse around this issue in our country today is that the walls go up and we don't necessarily see the partial truths that might be in some of these other perspectives. So I'm going to, suggest that, how many of us are there? Four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. The tape can go off. Yeah, let's have a couple of you, maybe one of you.
Secured.
One or two of you come up here.
Also,
are you two?
I don't know.
Okay, I'm going to assign this group perspective A, this group perspective B, this one perspective C. I guess I'll have to speak out of five, or the fifth one. Perspective D over here. Now, what I'd like you to do as a group is to spend a few minutes digesting what that perspective basically is. Perhaps you've heard, you've known people who said things like that. And then after you've got familiarized yourself as a group with that perspective, we're going to pull together in the plenary and have a common discussion. And the idea is you as members of that group, individuals who are sitting in that group, will try to express things out of that perspective. Does that make sense? Okay, so spend a little time reading and conversing about it, getting a clear sense of what it's about. Now, I'm going to invite any members from any of the groups to kind of jump into the conversation, but try to remember what you're trying to do is to speak out and represent this perspective that your group has been assigned. But any individuals in the group are free to respond. Okay, what should be done today about poverty? Poverty, you know, welfare system's a mess. We've got all these poor people around. We shouldn't have all these poor people around. What should be done?
Well, obviously it's a problem of society, because if society was able to facilitate through better programs and stuff, we wouldn't have this problem.
Well, we need better programs to start with. I mean, it's just facilitating the programs. No matter how well you facilitate a bad program, it's not going to really work. You've got to concentrate on the programs that you've got and make sure that they're actually doing what you want to do. It's the economy, just the way you structure it.
And even more than just the programs, we need to make sure that people have living wages, not just jobs. And in absence of the living wages, we need to continue to give economic assistance by individual needs, not just a cookie cutter, one size fits all.
But you think this can occur through the economy as it is?
This is definitely an economical problem.
Well, I think we just have to let the free market set wages. The government has shown itself totally incapable of responding to any of these things. And I'm really sick of my tax dollars going to programs that don't work for no benefit anybody. When they just get locked into poverty and they just don't like it.
You're saying
an agreement back there?
So totally, yeah.
How do you folks back here feel about that? You can agree with him?
I'm afraid I have to agree an awful lot, buddy. I don't think there's any reason in this world that I can think of that we should continue to grant raises whenever an ADC mother happens to get another child. If she's on ADC for good cause, and I'm not arguing with people who need help, but I do argue with people that figure they get another raise every year by having another kid.
I think you should come over here in perspective A.
Maybe yeah. That's where I belong. I don't
know. Well, I kind of feel like somewhere we've lost the perspective of families helping families like they used to back 30, 40 years ago, and everybody depends on the government or some impersonal entity to solve their problems. I mean, what the answer is, I honestly don't know, but somewhere we've lost the nuclear family hanging together, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, all working together like they did in rural America 30 years ago.
Okay, so you want to be a strong proponent of stronger family responsibility.
Uh-huh.
Okay, how about this group here? You've got a little bit in there, but what should be done about poverty?
I think society has to take responsibility for poverty, though, because to say that an individual chooses that life or on their own is, to me, ridiculous. A person does not make a choice as to where they are born, what they are born into. When you look at the statistics that are true in this country right now, what we're doing is pushing more people into the poverty level by the fact that there's this gap between the rich and the poor. Society has to take some responsibility for that. There are always going to be those who need assistance, and society should have to take responsibility for that and provide means by which they can, in fact, move themselves out of a hole.
Okay.
Society being who? Society
is
or just people?
Us. Public or us. Private, either one. Society is us.
Yeah, government is us too.
Sure.
So government programs, this so-called safety net, becomes part of the solution to lift people out of poverty or stop people who are falling into a pit because the economy has shifted out of their favor. I quite frankly think that the economic system in fact is skewed to a certain segment of the population. It favors one, it does not favor the other. And then people who are out of favor can really find themselves in deep trouble.
So you would take strong issue with this comment over here about the free market.
Oh, yeah. Right on.
But I've really worked hard for everything I've gotten. I don't understand why other people just don't get their butts in gear and do that. We pull ourselves up, and I think we've got to cut all these government programs.
Did you start out below sea level on your little hike towards success?
Well,
everybody with you? I mean, good grief. You sound like somebody who started out pretty high and just had everything handed to you.
I've got to say, though, that I really do appreciate the earnestness of that point of view, that I hear people, when they believe that, they really believe that people can lift themselves out by their own hard work, blood, sweat, and tears to wherever they want to go.
Well, 75 years ago, I made buggy whips. And all of a sudden, you know, the buggy kind of went out of style, and the government didn't come around and retrain me.
But 75 years ago, there were a lot more opportunities open to you, too. This is the era that we live in today is not 75 years ago or 100 or when our immigrant grandparents came here. This is a different society today than it was then.
And while every individual is important and every class distinction even and every part of the of one's social situation is important and everybody has validity and worth as individuals, the society has to provide a way to give access for people through both public and private social services and other means to be able to accomplish their fullness and their wholeness.
In former times, we used to emphasize the what people could do, sort of a can-do kind of atmosphere. Now, when government takes over, they are emphasizing the lacks that people have. You know, if you look at the interview on TV, and it's always the worst people get the most. So we've through our government emphasized that if you tell a bad enough story, you can get more. So
talk to the flood victims of 1993 with whom I worked. Many of them were very much of your ideological point of view until suddenly they had no house, they had no income, and they had to accept help. And where did it come from? It came through FEMA, which is a federal agency. It came through, they automatically got food stamps. They automatically got a financial assistance. These are farmers who found it very difficult
to accept help. But when I talked to them afterwards, their attitude towards government programs were phenomenally different than they had been before. And if we hadn't had that safety net for them, we would have had a whole significant percentage of people totally overwhelmed in poverty by that 1993 flood. Because most of them lost everything, and some of them couldn't even plant the next year. And they were given a tremendous amount of help. And it was government programs, social programs, that were there to help people in a crisis. And I had one man say to me, I was the most judgmental person about all welfare programs until this happened. And now I understand what it means to have that society there helping me to survive this catastrophe so that I can make a difference. And I'm not one caught in poverty, is what he said. I had a pretty good income. If I had been poor to begin with, talk to the people who in the Mississippi River Valley were already in poverty before the flood. See, that's very different when we're placed in that situation.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm really upset that they're talking about cutting back on the home mortgage interest deduction. Now there, I think, now there's a good program.
But our stance is that long-term assistance is not in the best interest. This emergency assistance we could go along with, because there's sometimes...
But we're not saying that it necessarily... We're not talking about length of time. We're talking about having things available to be accessed as one needs to. And we know statistically the people that who receive these programs that are provided by the government, most of them receive them short-term, not long-term. That long-term thing is a political... lie.
The long-term assistance stuff comes from government programs for wealthy people, though.
That's right.
That's why we need to change the government thing. The home mortgage deal that you're talking about, have you ever thought about the folks who live at a very low level and they have FICA, Social Security taxes taken from their wages? Now, you just see what's taken out of your wages. It's like 7.6%, but I, as an employer, pay another 7.6%. When you add that up, that's almost 15% of your income. Why do people in that low level have to pay that much to support old folks who have plenty? So I think we really need to change our economic policies. And those kind of things we never even think about.
We're not allowed to, because a lot of rich people are saying, hey, cushy suits me, and I've got my hand on the boat. But we've got to take another look at this and make things a tad more equitable.
Well, I think what we need is a tax cut. I agree.
Tax cut for the low end.
Then you're going to destroy my incentive to create the jobs that you want people to have.
Just the lowest end. Why not for the people who make less than $15,000? You know, you can give up that little bit. It's not going to be very much. It's not going to hurt your millions of dollars that you're making.
I resemble that remark.
Any other comment? Any more input, especially from some of you who haven't had a chance to get your oar in the water?
Well, I really still go back to what Paula said about families helping each other. And years ago, before welfare was actually set up, churches and organizations, and to me, that's society. It was society, not government, that helped each other. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we need to get back to more of that.
That still happens. But society is more than that. It's government as well. I mean, the church still does a tremendous amount of helping, of assistance, and especially in emergencies. But I think society is a much wider ring than that. And society isn't what it was 30 years ago. I mean, it would be wonderful maybe if it were. Maybe it wouldn't be so wonderful. I don't know.
Okay, I'm going to kind of call an end to our trying to speak out of these perspectives, just to first of all get a sense of, well, let me say that with some obvious exceptions,
there's one speaker out here,
I sense for some of you there was a little bit of a natural fit between your assigned perspective and what you said with considerable passion at times, I think in a very positive sense.
Or were some of you in some positions that clearly were not where you're at?
But he did it very well.
In other words, what did it feel like to try to speak out of a perspective that is not your own?
I sensed in our group, although we were supposed to be speaking from the same perspective, we had five different perspectives on what that perspective would be. And I didn't always agree with the perspective of some of the other people, and I don't think they always agreed with mine. Mm-hmm. And I also got a feeling, as we listened to this, that sometimes when somebody was talking about society, they really meant government. When they were talking about personal stuff, they really meant society. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult for us.
The terms were slippery.
To
really hear what one another is saying. Other observations or feelings that you had as you were trying to think through or talk through these perspectives?
I think that, you know, there's some good in every one of these perspectives. And but for people who, you know, I don't know if it really came out here except for, you know, nice performance, but there are people, maybe minorities even, within each perspective in our larger society that really have agendas, and it's really their purpose to meet those agendas and take the worst or the most self-serving of any one of these things to work it for their own advantage and make everything else from the other perspectives look really bad.
And to really characterize some of the other perspectives.
Yeah, and you get these really lousy caricatures of what they are, and then, I mean, to come up with a solution is really impossible, or at least dismaying.
I was able to find people on that side of the room, you know, that were like, yes, you're in support of me, you know. Because, you know, I could take that and say, sure, there was a part of that supported me, and a lot of times I could nod my head, you know, so it's possible to not be both. I was kind of cheered by that, that it wasn't like, you know, the fight against the world. Mm-hmm. But we could maybe cage some support. Come on over to our side.
I think if I understand your point, that I would really concur in that it seems to me in this, probably one of the reasons I could role play this is because, one, I've heard all these perspectives so many times from different people, and two, I really think reflecting each perspective is some real wisdom, but that a lot of times that wisdom is easily buried between an avalanche of prejudice. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to sort out, you know, where is the wisdom. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'd like us to turn over on the flip side of this, because what I'd like to have us think about in the remaining time we have is some of the theological assumptions that are operating in these different perspectives. This is not to say that, well, one of these is Christian and the others aren't, or that sort of thing. I think it's a mixed bag. But if anything, there's some different theological understandings or views of who human beings are that are operating in some of these perspectives. And that, it's building a little bit on the comment Jack just made, that I think there's, you know, the times when these become an avalanche to be able to say, well, now what's really going on in that perspective, and how do we give some due consideration of what's being said there. First of all, the question, to what extent are human beings self-determining? I mean, clearly this was a fairly easy one, I think, to discern, that on this side of the room it was much more a sense of, yes, it's individuals that make these choices, and, you know, we've either got to encourage them to make the good choices or penalize them if they make the bad choices, i.e. if they have more kids or don't want to work or whatever. On the other hand, the C and the D perspectives reflect a more social or communal understanding of human beings and how they behave, which is why from Mary Ann we heard society, you know, constantly reiterating the social context, the social, are being socially embedded human beings. We aren't just autonomous individuals who
somehow can make all those free choices apart from social situations. Related question, to what extent should human beings be held responsible for their situation? A and B, again, emphasizing how individuals sin through the personal choices they make. But the others here really having a more social, structural understanding of sin. I think sin is also relevant in relationship to these perspectives, but it's more thinking about it in terms of the social structures or the policies that themselves perpetuate injustice and how those too need to be challenged from other perspective of our faith. Or the question, what is the basis for human respect? A would say, you know, we'll respect those who rise above their circumstances by acting from self-interest. B grants respect based on whether people conform to the norms that the wider society values, and therefore working hard, not having children out of wedlock, and other kinds of social norms are seen as important things that one needs to measure up to. That's part of what, that's how one gains respect. C is a bit more generous in that respect, conferring worth on all persons despite what they do or fail to do. And D, as we heard it come through a number of the comments, seeks to change economic conditions so that all might participate in the economy with dignity. I'm saying there's I think, very different ways of how one acquires respect in these different perspectives, but those often come colliding together and in some at times vicious kinds of ways when we're engaging in discussion of these. And then finally the question, how are human beings motivated to become productive participants in economic life? A would say, shouldn't go about trying to rescue individuals from their mistakes or their lack of motivation. And B would be a little bit hard-nosed, saying, well, people should work, we should penalize those who don't. Perhaps recognizing that people's self-interest is not likely to motivate them to accept low-paying menial jobs that are not going to help very much, at least in terms of enabling people to rise out of poverty. C tries to make people more confident and competent so that they can participate in economic life. And D, of course, wants to change the system to provide more meaningful jobs at a decent income. And that's what will motivate people to work. let me just say a word about the E perspective, because it's based on an understanding that it's a complex perspective, but it emphasizes a kind of culture of poverty, much of it reinforced by dynamics of race as well as social class, and the fact that the role models, the opportunities, the kind of culture that probably many of us in this room take for granted, the kind of nurturing culture that enables us to become productive economic actors in society, is often not there. And how do we address that wider kind of situation? Each of these perspectives, by the way, are connected with prominent figures involved in the public debate. And I think events of the last several weeks make it very apparent that particularly proponents of the A and the B perspectives have been very much carrying the day in terms of the kind of welfare reform legislation that's just been passed. The E perspective, by the way, is one that's basically based on that of William Julius Wilson, those of you who have done some reading in this area. Charles Murray, I think, was A, and Lawrence Mead was B, and I'm not sure. I know Piven was one of these others. So these are based on, you know, some prominent analyses that are out there and part of the public debate right now. But I, building on the question over here, I would like for us in the remaining minutes to build on the question that you're saying. What would each of us draw from the different perspectives for the sake of policies to address people living in poverty, their situation, and that might have more effectively enabled about in the beginning of the hour to move out of poverty, those actual human beings to move out of poverty. What are some of the partial truths, some of the values, some of the positive things that you see in the different perspectives here that might be helpful, or perspectives that go beyond any of these five?
Having worked with a number of people who are in this category of trying to work at the minimum wage and support a family, mm-hmm. I think that my experience has been most of the women who I've known that have been on ADFC have wanted off. They want to work. But I have seen jobs that I've had to offer people not able to support them, actually put their families in a worse position than if they stay on welfare. So I would say that the idea that there's dignity and pride with work, doing work to support yourself and get your family into a better situation coming out of these perspectives is a very valid one. But then I also think that out of these perspectives has to come a different system for providing it. There has to be, you can't expect people to do that in and of themselves. Living in a rural town in Iowa, for example, if you were to throw the women who are on that support off the system without providing them some transportation, some child care, some training and education, it will not work. It'll just have people out on the street because they have to have those support systems to get to the point where they can actually be self-supporting. Teaching in a community college, I run into people all the time who are working their best to try to educate themselves to be able to get those kinds of jobs. But they have to have some kind of a net there that helps them until they can get to that point. That's why, you know, as I say, my own personal experience, the idea that even that women have babies to get more money is offensive to me because I know there are some out there. Mm-hmm. But boy, the majority of people I've worked with have not been in that position. They want offices. They want to have pride. They want to have freedom to make choices in and of themselves. But the system, I don't agree that the system that we've had has been a good one, but I sure don't agree that the reform that we've just passed is going to solve any problems. I think it's going to create a lot more problems than it ever solves, and it's going to cost more money than what we've been expending.
I wonder, as far as a community trying to work, I mean, little churches, big churches, for people who need child care so that they can work and get off welfare, I mean, that would be a big step, and that would address community helping themselves and not need to be...
It'd be great, but, you know, if you look at our churches, a lot of our churches, Lutheran churches, the women are all working to provide themselves with boats and campers and lots of other things.
Or children's clothes or food
or whatever.
I really get angry when people say women are working so that they can have this glamorous life. Like, women are working because they've got to support themselves.
Well, some women are. Not all women are. And not all women are. I agree with you very much. Yeah. But what I'm saying is a lot of our churches would have trouble getting the people together to do that.
But see, I guess what I'm saying is it comes down to stewardship. I mean, every time we talk about stewardship, we're asked to stretch. Mm-hmm. You know, and I look at my church, and I know that there are some people who can't, some people who won't, some people who can but haven't really thought it through. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's some real potential if there was the vision but, you know, with what's going on right now, it has to happen. What's with a welfare reform that's mm-hmm. coming up now? It has to happen. You know, if not child care, some other sort of church assistance.
I think we need to use much better stewardship of the resources that we use to support people who are in need. For instance, a lot of times you will hear about a family
that's in poverty and they can't find a decent place to live because they can't find a three-bedroom apartment or they can't find a house that will take care of their five kids. Instead of saying, are there two families that can use a larger thing together? Or we're subsidizing people's gasoline. Instead of, we may have 12 people going to the same place and they, they live in farm areas or something. Mm-hmm. Instead of doing that, talk to the employer and say, can you subsidize a van that picks up these people? Instead of us subsidizing gasoline so 12 cars can go to the same place. And in terms of daycare, that's really an important thing, but why can't we have people who are not working that shift helping in that daycare with their children and other people's children and working much more cooperatively instead of all thinking of ourselves as nuclear families that have to stay in the same place that we were at before? We need to look at these things more creatively and get back into the communities that... Mm-hmm.
They used to happen in the olden days when we didn't have this problem.
I was assigned perspective B, but I have a hard time with that because I'm in perspective C. As a school social worker, I've worked with families in poverty and I've seen the Head Start program and how wonderful early education provides for low-income families and how they're required to spend one day a week and learn parenting skills and it provides a network of support. I'd like to see the Head Start expanded.
It seems that throughout the history of this country, we've had different ideas about who needs assistance and why they need assistance. And I understand the Social Security system has begun to help widows with small children. And maybe perhaps I'm wrong on that, but then as it has taken a different course, you know, it's really helped out old people. And then, you know, other programs were intended result, and then they've shifted and gone off someplace. And it seems like we really kind of need some group or some overseeing individual to watch these things. And, I mean, we feel like we're in a really big mess right now. We can't quite figure out what to do about it. And everybody has their little subsidy. Like, I have my home mortgage subsidy. Well, it's wonderful. But I personally would be willing to give that up if I knew that it would help somebody else who has a little less than I have. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like these policies that we've created have really screwed our society up. And to me, that's one of the issues. But I don't know if other people feel the same way.
I mean, I think especially in terms of AFDC, there's been dramatic shifts of, you know, what its original intents were, and, you know, and especially now with saying, well, but all those women have to get a paying job now.
Well,
and,
yeah,
and that's been a total flip from the original intent of what that was all about.
And that's a really short-sighted thing because now we have to pay other people to take care of their children during the day. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's really... harms our society to remove all these children from their own parents and let somebody else raise them.
Just two quick comments that I find interesting to think about. One is that the United States just does miserably in all the areas that we're talking about relative to every other industrial country. And I think it's partly our arrogance of, you know, that old bumper sticker, we're number one, that really gets in the way of us examining what do other countries do? You know, what does Germany do? What does France do? What does Sweden do? And they do things much, much better in terms of, if you judge that by the well-being of children, for example, and others. And the second one is, you brought up kind of theological assumptions. I wonder what the welfare debate in this country would look like if we used Jubilee as the model. Because what Jubilee sets out to do, what it biblically set out to do was every 50 years was to break the cycles of poverty. It really acknowledges that poverty is an ugly thing. It does terrible things to communities, to people, to families, and somehow that cycle has to be broken. If that was the spirit of welfare reform, it would look very, very different, it seems to me, than what we now have.
Certainly wouldn't be welfare appeal. It's currently occurring. Yeah. Well, I have no doubt that because of events that have been going on in Washington, this is going to continue to be a really critical area of deliberation in our society. And this was just a small attempt to say, how do we get into or get a sense of what some of those different perspectives are? I would just call your attention to some of the other sessions later this week that Jack will be leading. In other words, there'll be other ways to continue to move forward with particular, you know, discussions that relate to this. But I have a sense that as the fall debate or campaign warms up, whatever, you know, the legislation that was just passed and supposedly by now signed by Clinton is not going to be the end of the story, but beginning of a new round of asking some really hard questions, including some of the kinds of questions that you all started to surface today. So thank you for coming.